And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
Anthony Scaramucci was like a shooting star in the night skies of Washington last summer. He was appointed on July 21st as White House Communications Director, played bumper cars with many of the central figures in the Trump administration at that time, and then found himself bounced out by the new chief of staff, John Kelly. The Mooch, as he's known by his friends, is very much like the man he served. He is a pugnacious New Yorker who gives as good as he gets and knows how to make good copy. I sat down with him last week when he was visiting the University of Chicago, and we talked about his experiences and some of the turmoil in the White House today. Anthony Scaramucci, good to see you again here on the campus of the University of Chicago.
It's great to be here. There'll be no bets for me this year. I lost a bet to you 5 years ago.
For a good cause.
It was for a good cause.
Okay, for epilepsy research.
You've done an amazing job.
My wife's foundation cure.
You've done an amazing job.
You know, I shaved my mustache. Thank you. I shouldn't cut you off when you're being so gracious.
No, I'm just saying you've done an amazing job. You've raised the awareness, and you're going to get us to a cure. So God bless you.
Happy
to lose that bet.
So a side light to that whole thing was I shaved my mustache off, as you know, to raise money for epilepsy. You contributed to that. And I got seven steps away from that, and my wife turned to me and said, I always hated that thing anyway. She said, keep it off. It's 33 years into our marriage. So I was wondering what else she hadn't told me.
She's giving you good feedback.
Yeah, that's good. She always does.
You don't have to go to your social media page to get the feedback.
Exactly.
Like me.
So Andy Warhol talked about, you know, the 15 minutes of fame.
Yep.
You had like 15 days or something
11,
like that.
11.
But okay.
Because you're like the first person to actually exaggerate it to the other end. Everybody says 10 days.
This
it really
is
hurts
the,
my feelings. I feel like
all good treatment
of,
here.
Why chip me out of that 11th day? But let's go with 15. We can have
we treat our guests
we
can, well here.
A lot
I
of politicians have
days.
An imaginary moment. So, I was in 15
but,
days in the White
but
House.
I want to talk. There's plenty to talk about what's going on now. But I want to talk first about you and your family. And because I know you're really proud of it, of your family. And we both have immigrant stories, but tell me about yours.
Well, I mean, my immigrant story is probably traditional to a lot of Italian Americans. My grandfather came here from my mother's side in actually 1895. It's a weird thing. My great grandfather came in 1895. My grandfather was born here in the United States. He lived the first 7 years of his life in the U.S. and then moved back to Italy. So he was a U.S. citizen by birth. My grandmother, the one I was the closest to, she came here at the age of 18 in 1923, and she started out as a housemaid. And so I've never forgotten that. And so every time I'm in a hotel room or any place, I make sure that I leave an extra tip. I think that, you know, this person is obviously or could be somebody's grandmother or it could be somebody's mom. So we came from humble family. Nobody went to college. The only person in my family at my generational level, and so my mom and dad are from 10, you know, my dad's from a family of 7, my mom's from a family of 3. Those 10 people went on to marry 10 people, and they made 40 people. And so of those 40, you know, cousins and siblings and so forth, only 2 of us went to college. Only one of us went to law school. So I come from That would be me.
Yes.
And I come from a hardworking, blue-collar, middle-class family.
Your grandfather, Scaramucci, came over around 1920 or so, is that?
Let me bifurcate him. So my mom's side, father was born here, moved back to Italy. Her mom came at the age of 18 to be a maid. On my father's side, both of the parents married in Italy. My dad's parents.
Yep.
They moved to the United States and they went in the wrong direction. They went into the northeastern coal mining area of Scranton, Wilkes-Barre, where Joe Biden is from, Hillary Clinton is from. The interesting thing about Secretary Clinton is when I hear her voice on TV, it makes me think of my Aunt Eleanor. They have the exact same northeastern Pennsylvanian accent. You know, she was raised there.
I hope you treated Eleanor better. But,
hey, look, I never said a bad thing about her. Okay, go back and check. I like talking about policy. I never attack anybody personally. I obviously have disagreements with people on policy.
Sure.
But, you know, you may remember this. I'm close to Valerie Jarrett. You know, she's been to my conference. Obviously.
As have I.
Robert Wolf, yourself. Yeah. I mean, thing is, I think we got to figure out a way to bring this thing together. So I don't like throwing eggs and tomatoes at people personally.
Yeah.
Not to say
that
I haven't gotten some hits personally, but that's okay.
The reason I asked you about all that history, though, it's interesting. And I want to get to the Long Island part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned my father was an immigrant too. He came over in 1922, so about the same time.
Yeah.
And
rough time for immigrants, by the way. Nina, you know, no Italian, Nita Pillai.
Right.
My grandparents couldn't find any work.
Right. So this current debate about immigration, my feelings about it are sort of informed by my own family's experience and the fact that, you know, my father was a refugee from Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the reason I so love this country is because he was able to come here, find a life, serve his country, and so on. And as you point out, there were a lot of people who didn't want people from Eastern Europe. They didn't want people from Italy. They didn't
No question.
And in fact, quotas were set up a few years after your grandfather arrived and my father arrived. So how do you process this debate today? Because it seems to me that some these immigrant families who are coming from other places today are counterparts to who our families were.
This is the thing about our politics right now. I mean, again, for me, and maybe you've been able to find this, but I haven't, where I haven't identified the politician that has the same political fingerprint as me, where every single item in every category lines up both vertically and horizontally. So if you ask me about marriage equality as an example, you may or may not remember this, but Chad Griffin and I are very close.
Yeah, I do remember, yeah.
I'm a very big sponsor of the Human Rights Campaign. I was part of the initiative in New York State to bring marriage equality to the Republican side. We got those four senators to vote on that. I gave money for the Proposition 8 thing in the Supreme Court.
Yeah. No, I and so, Anthony, so when you go, I understand
you go over,
all that.
When you go over the whole categories of everything, I'm in this hodgepodge where I probably don't fit into any political party bucket. But specifically on immigration, I stand with 86 or 87% of the country that wants a resolution and what I would call a positive resolution on what we call the Dreamers or however you want to define the people that are in this limbo period. And so I stand with them. When you talk about specifically related to immigration in the country today, 2018 versus 1918 or 1923, when my folks got here, or my grandparents, I would say obviously the country is very different. There's a tremendous amount of anxiety in this country right now. There's a tremendous amount of economic desperation, even though these employment data numbers look okay and the jobs numbers look better and the wages look better. The middle class and the lower middle class has lost ground, David. I mean, I got trained as an economist, and so I can look through the data and I can tell you that. But I will say something else I think is very important for your podcast people, because you probably get a lot of Republicans on here, but we all have different opinions. So I'll share with you my opinion. I missed something that I should have seen. And so I want to tell your listeners what it was. Ready?
Yeah.
I missed what happened in my neighborhood that I grew up in. And so just quickly on my neighborhood, my dad started as an hourly worker. He eventually got himself a desk job, but he worked
in Port Washington.
He worked 42 years for the same company. It was called Gotham Sand and Stone. And so not to give everybody a geology lesson, but I'll talk quickly. Long Island is a glacial deposit. And so as the Ice Age receded and the glacier went back up to the North Pole, it left remnants. It crushed the Catskills, which were taller than the Himalayas. And it left Long Island. It left Block Island, the elbow of Cape Cod, Martha's Vineyard, Nantucket, as it headed back up to the North Pole. On Long Island.
I got to get to 2018, so advance the story.
So anyway, you got all the sand in the world on Long Island that built all of those skyscrapers.
Yeah.
Okay. And so those immigrants did that.
Yes.
And they came in droves. those jobs were high-paying jobs. If you price my father's job today, 45 years later, his real purchasing power is down 35%. So the point I'm making is that I went to Harvard Law School. I went up the spire of the economic elites. I confirmed all of my biases with rich people at places like Goldman Sachs and the salons of the Republican Party. And it wasn't until I joined the Trump campaign and I ended up in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where I crossed the Secret Service security line, took my day pin off, walked through the line. Why are you here? And people were starting to talk to me. I said, oh, my God, I'm talking to the people I grew up with. I'm talking to the people in my neighborhood that are struggling.
Yeah.
There were only two candidates that saw in 2016 that struggle. That was Bernard Sanders and Donald J. Trump.
Yeah.
The other 17 or 18 candidates didn't see it.
I get all that. Just to get back to the question I asked you, though, I find it—
No, but that's why, there's an immigration issue, because those people that are already here in the country are so worried about their jobs. You're asking me my opinion.
That's been the case every time there's been anti-immigrant sentiment.
All I'm for, me specifically, if it's about Trump or any of these other people, all I'm for is a process of legal immigration and a process where we continue the American spirit of having waves of immigrants come to the country and assimilate themselves into the country. But I don't think any of us should be for quote unquote illegal immigration. I don't think anybody is for illegal immigration. That's a dangerous thing for a country that has a safety net.
You know, all of the plans for comprehensive immigration reform penalize people who would penalize the ones that have been voted on in Congress would penalize people for coming to this country illegally, would put them at the back of the line for any sort of citizenship. So nobody who came legally would be disadvantaged. But the thing that the reason I bring it up is because I find the rhetoric, the sort of depiction of immigrants. I look at these people, some who may be here undocumented, many who aren't, who are here legally, I should say. But these are like hardworking folks who are doing, you know, really, really, and oftentimes jobs that a lot of other people don't want to do, certainly not the jobs your father would do.
Not going to get any pushback from me. I'm just trying to explain to you where
I thoroughly agree with you, but we can either have a reasoned discussion about immigration, not you and me, but as a country, or we can appeal to people's biases on this. Mm-hmm. And as a son of an immigrant, mm-hmm. And knowing the rhetoric that was used about your family and my family,
the rhetoric is still used about my family. Okay, how many people? You're named the White House Communications Director. Seth Meyers is calling you a human pinky ring on national television. If I was African American, is he going to call me a human piece of fried chicken? There's no way he's going to do that. Okay, so I'm Jim Tan in laundry descends on the White House. Tony Goomba takes over the press shop. The last bastion of attack, ethnicity is with the Italian Americans. And by the way, every Italian American knows that. Chris Cuomo yells at me, says, don't bring it up to anybody because nobody cares.
The president is not engaging in anti-Italian slurs, but he arguably is engaging in anti-Hispanic slurs when he suggests that the bulk of these people implies that the bulk of these folks who are here are somehow associated with MS-13.
Do you know anything about MS-13? Do you live in an area where MS-13 exists?
I do. No, MS-13 is not as active.
It's the town of Port Washington that you reference.
Yeah, I understand. But Anthony, they do not represent the bulk of immigrants. They certainly don't represent these DACA kids. So why should that be invoked in a way as to imply that those DACA kids are somehow a manifestation of that?
That's why this is going to be a fun podcast, because we obviously are going to see this thing very differently. I listen to the president very carefully, and a lot of things that he does I dislike. I've told him that. I've said it on television. I'm not a pure, tyrannical Trump apologist. these guys want to have a military parade. I think that's a ridiculous thing to do. And if someone asks me about it, you ask me, I'll tell you 100 reasons why that's a ridiculous thing for us to do. So, you know, I'm not.
Well, give me the
I'm
top
not,
two as long as
the
you're
top.
There.
The top two is speak softly and carry a big stick. Number one, we can
Teddy
go back
Roosevelt.
To Teddy
yes.
Roosevelt on the way we should think about mm-hmm. the world. And number two, the United States, other than the unilateral decision to go into Iraq in 2003, has primarily been a counterpuncher, which is what the president himself calls himself. He says he's a counterpuncher. So when you're rolling tanks and doing la-la stuff like that, it's too boisterous. We don't need to be doing that
yeah,
as a nation.
I agree.
And so I totally disagree.
I agree.
The money and give it to the veterans in a different way. You want to celebrate the veterans? I want to celebrate the veterans. I love the veterans. I've been to Iraq on troop support missions. I've been to Afghanistan on troop support missions. Just don't do that.
Yeah.
So I'm not a puritanical Trump
apologist.
Well,
that's why we have parades on Memorial Day.
Mazel tov. By the way, the Gulf War I parade in
New York. That's not Italian.
That's not Italian, but I'm
now you're,
up in
now
a
you're
Jewish,
signifying to me.
I grew up in a Jewish neighborhood. Right? I know a lot about it. I know the difference between a Shagits and a Shiksa. Not a lot of Italians know that difference. Okay, but here's what I'm just saying. I was at the Gulf War ticker tape parade on Wall Street when I was 27 years old after mm-hmm. Gulf War I. I got that. That made sense. There was a reason to celebrate the troops coming home, and we want to make sure that they feel comforted. But we don't have any reason to be doing a military parade right now, and so I disagree with it. So I'm not a puritanical Trump apologist, but on immigration, I have really listened to what the president has said, and I do feel that they surgically remove some of the things that he says. I've heard him say over and over again in one campaign stop after the next that he's for waves and waves of immigration. I've heard him say that, you know, he did say that line that the Mexicans don't give us their best. I understand that. And that's been blown out to mean he means all Mexicans. He's walked that back 100 times. No one will listen to that.
But he walks it forward again as well.
Hey, like I said, the Charlottesville thing, I totally disagreed with. George Stephanopoulos asked me about that on his show. I said, hey, there's no – anybody that understands the rise of Nazi Germany and anybody that has done any research on the Holocaust, which I did when I was at Harvard Law School, I took a course at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy on what the Roosevelt administration's response was to the Holocaust. Anybody that understands
Not
the Holocaust
–
Not good. He's embarrassing, actually.
Right.
Embarrassing. But you know what? There was a lot of, you know.
But you know what? People argue, the politics,
a lot of, Jews
the
in
politics
that
of immigration
that,
were not good then. That was one of the things was at play. You know.
So, but again, my opinion is probably different from the president's. I want legal immigration. I want a ton of people assimilating into the country. I have no problem with any race, color, or creed, or sexual orientation. I've lived my life like that. I've got 5 beautiful children that I've pressed that on very hard. But if you're making the point that there is tension in the immigration and the rhetoric
I'm making the point
is stylized
that we should
poorly.
Not. We should not caricature immigrants.
I think the rhetoric is stylized poorly, okay? But mm-hmm. I think we can, if we calm ourselves down, we can get to the right decision. And if you go to the 55-minute open where he called the cabinet room a studio, God bless him, he says, you know, the 55-minute –
where he talked about the Bill of Love?
Yeah. Well, you go to that scenario, okay – you all of a sudden get a window into how the guy really thinks, and then what ends up happening to you, one of the reasons why I have a strong dislike for what's going on in our society right now, special interest groups intercede and they tug on our candidates, they tug on our elected officials, and they bring them to points of view where the bell curve of the population, the bell curve of the electorate is not in that category. And so the louder voices, the ones that screech the most, David, have a higher weighting with our elected officials and our candidates. And I would really like to encourage people listening to your podcast or people here at the University of Chicago, get up, end your apathy, and speak out and speak
well,
out for what you think is sensible.
Well, you're sitting at the Institute of Politics. Our whole mission here is to encourage people to be involved across the political spectrum.
Let me say this to you. Somebody asked me this at Columbia yesterday. What would I do? You know, term limits, blah, blah, all this stuff. No, there's one thing I would do, okay? Just do what Australia does. Mandatory voting.
Mm-hmm.
You will totally change the landscape. A lot of these politicians don't want that because once you mandatorily vote, you've now homogenized the electorate and now the product has to change.
Product has to change.
It becomes a less extreme product.
These guys
will never do that, though, because they like hanging on to power. Okay? It's a
you're
group
right,
of sickening
though,
people,
about,
by and large.
You're right about the loudest voices getting the most attention. And some would argue that's why that was one of the president's great insights, is that he knew how to command the media because he knew how to sort of light himself on fire.
Now, how's he doing in the media? How do you think he's doing in the media?
I think he is doing well on the media that his base listens to. I think he's doing very well with that group. I think the media is doing its job, which is to scrutinize him. Because I sat in the White House. I didn't love the media coverage all the time myself.
I don't think he's doing well with the media. If we're gonna have an objective conversation. Yeah. He's obviously not doing well with the media. Maybe there's a sliver of the media that he's doing well with, but there's a way that he could be doing way better with.
Well, I agree with that. You and I both agree with that. But what I will say is, he could not.
In the White House longer than the media. You think it's a good idea to declare war on the media?
100% not. And you said that when you got there in your 11 days. Now that you've corrected me, your 11 days as communications director.
It was 954,000 seconds. We could use that too. I tried to get the Wall Street Journal.
That's great. You probably have it divided up in many different ways.
Well, you got to do that. You know, it makes you feel
you're
better.
You're good
about
with
the
math.
Makes you feel better about the whole fiasco.
I thoroughly agree. My only point is that it was that instinct that also allowed him to win that Republican nomination, because he completely dominated the coverage. And now you were with several other candidates who didn't make it because he was like in Technicolor and they were in black and white. And maybe he learned the wrong lesson from it.
But something else was going on too, which I just want to point out to everybody. The American people are fed up with the nonsense. And maybe the establishment American people aren't, but I'm talking about the people that I grew up with, the guys that I grew up with in my neighborhood didn't go to college. They're out clamming. They're Bay Shoremen, or the people in Albuquerque, New Mexico, where the factories have gotten closed down and moved to old Mexico, and they're driving around delivering Domino's pizza. They don't like the rhetoric anymore. They don't like the sanitized politician.
I understand. He tapped right into that. He understood that.
He's a smack mouth politician. He's the first shock jock to be the president of the United States.
Yeah, fair enough. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back with Anthony Scaramucci. Back on your story for a second. So Port Washington, working class community. A lot of Italian Americans there, a lot of Italian immigrants.
Big mix, though, David, because like F. Scott Fitzgerald book, The Great Gatsby, East Egg is actually the peninsula of Port Washington. The tip is Sands Point. It was loaded with Gatsby-style large mansions. Like every community.
You didn't live in one of those.
I didn't. Like every community, they had a very middle class, smaller housed enclave. However, I lived in the middle class. I would never dishonor or disrespect my dad's work ethic by telling you we grew up poor. We did not grow up poor. We had Sears Tough Skins. We were taking air conditioners in and out of the windows. We had macaroni on Sundays. I never felt in want for anything.
Yeah.
I feel
the same way. I grew up in a housing development.
Yeah, we had a budget.
I felt the same way.
You know, I mean, it was a great American upbringing. And we also believed in the aspirational society. But most of the people I grew up with now are in a desperational situation and less of an aspirational one.
It was that was the time of the Margiotta machine.
Joe went to jail for – you know, you get guys on mail fraud and tax evasion, Al Capone in this great city, ba-boom. Joe, they got Joe on mail fraud. I remember when he went down. Joe was the most powerful guy in the area. And so people said
you may have been the most powerful Republican in the state.
Yeah, he introduced me to Ronald Reagan. I was the president of my high school. I had pimples on my forehead. I was wearing a 100% polyester suit. And I walked into the Plaza Hotel because Jolton Joe Margiotta took a group of us high school presidents to meet Ronald Reagan. And I'll never forget the meeting because they were protesting outside the Plaza Hotel for the nuclear arms race. And Joe said, "How you taking all this stuff?" And Reagan just looked at him and said, "Hey, if you're in this game, you got to just slough it off. You can't worry about it." He said, "Like a water off a duck's, you know what?" And so Jolton Joe Margiotta
said that in your presence.
Said it in my presence, and Reagan said that in my presence. I'll never forget it because I was so impressionable at that time. But Margiotta,
did you share that story with the president? That's a good one. He should hear that story.
I have shared that. That's interesting to say, because I have shared that story with the president. And by the way, I've had to tell that story to myself after listening to people on CNN or even Fox or looking at my Twitter feed, which I've stopped looking at. But here's what I would say to you, okay, about Margiotta. It was very interesting. People say to me, well, your dad was in a union. Yes, he was. Well, why was he a Republican? Joe Margiotta. He controlled the whole area.
Right. You also, another thing we have in common is the Mets.
I got to tell you, I'm very impressed that you know who Joe Margiotta is, though. I'm very impressed by that.
That's my thing. You know, I'm a political junkie.
He made Al D'Amato. You know that, right?
Yeah, I absolutely do. Yeah. The Mets.
The Mets, yeah.
Yeah, although you're a few years younger than me, so you missed the run-up to that 69 World Series. But
I remember them winning it, but I was too young. I was about six at the time.
Yeah, so my coming of age in baseball when I was 7 years old and the Mets just started in New York. My father had been a New York Giants fan.
Yeah, there you go.
And so we adopted the Mets, and they were bad.
Yeah.
They were really bad.
Yeah, they were.
They had some players named Pumpsy Green and Choo Choo Coleman and Marvelous Marv Thornberry, who was the only guy, I think, who ever hit several extra base hits in a game and missed first base each time and got called out.
They lost 120 games.
They were the portrait of ineptitude.
They played in the Polo Grounds that first year.
Yeah.
And, this is the greatest part of, like, America, the American dream. I used to deliver newspapers, Long Island Newsday. On a Wednesday after I collected the money, I would take the Long Island Railroad to Shea Stadium by myself, and I'd keep score of the game. And I used to play something called Strat-O-Matic Baseball.
Yeah, I remember Strat-O-Matic.
Okay, so I happen to own Strat-O-Matic Baseball now with the family that developed it, and I bought a piece of the New York Mets in 2011. And so that's how I got to know the Ricketts family so well, because of the owner's galas and networking and all that other stuff. So, I mean, it's an amazing, if you said to me, growing up in my neighborhood, doing what I did as a kid, wearing gold chains, having horns in my car, having a power booster on my Camaro, doing push-ups in the back of a parking lot, going into a disco. Okay, you used to do like 50 push-ups just to get your chest a little pumped up, okay?
Yes. I feel like I've walked into Saturday Night Fever here.
But, right, there you go. And my hair was blown back like Tony Manero. And then to go from that into the Harvard Law School, shedding my 100% polyester for like real natural fiber and converting all of that into a Goldman Sachs experience, building two hedge funds, and then the improbable story of working in the White House. Hey, man, it's a great country.
Yeah, it is a great country.
Yeah.
At Harvard Law School, one of your classmates was Barack Obama.
He was 2 years behind me.
Yeah.
Yeah, so he was there. I'm not one of these revisionist historians where I tell you I knew him very well, but we used to play Tuesdays and Thursdays hoops in the Hemingway gym. So all the gym rats knew each other. He was a first-year student when I was a third-year student. But my best Barack Obama story is in 2007. He came to the university club. You may not remember this. I supported him, and I bundled
for him. Yeah, I do remember.
And so I walked into the university club. There were seven or eight of us from law school, then Senator Obama from your great state of Illinois. We were handing him checks. I turned to him. I said, Senator, we didn't really know each other that well in law school, but I'm about to write you a big check. I said, can I lie to my friends and tell them that we knew each other? He laughed. He didn't miss a beat. He said, hey, if you double the amount of the check, we could take it back to Hawaii. I thought that was really funny. That was his personality. I mean, look, he's got a great personality.
Yes.
And by the way, I did. I doubled the amount of the check. And I went out and bundled for him because I said to myself, I'm a Republican. I thought he was a moderate voice. He had a lot of common sense. He ran congratulations. You guys ran an amazing campaign. I thought he was going to break a lot of different things. He was a Jackie Robinson of American politics, and I thought he was going to, make the world better. And by the way, a lot of things he did I agree with. We can talk about what they are. Some of the things he did I very strongly didn't agree with.
Well, one of the things you obviously didn't like was you felt he was too rough on Wall Street, that his language was too rough on Wall Street.
He's tough on Wall Street. I know we got into it a little bit at the CNN town hall meeting at the museum. It's tough on Wall Street.
That was like a breakthrough moment for you.
Looking back, but I wasn't really trying.
You challenged him on the...
It was interesting because I really wasn't even trying to challenge him. You know, I was just trying to say, hey, there is historical, if you study economic history, there's a historical nexus between Main Street and Wall Street. And even though Wall Street is currently dysfunctional, and it gets dysfunctional every 80 or so years, if you go back to 1907, 1929, the Panic of 1887, I couldn't get all that into the question, but I was just trying to say that there's a nexus between both of those, and so let's not be hard on each other. There's a blame to go all
but
around.
Anthony, you know what? From where I was sitting, he stuck his neck out to make sure that the financial system didn't collapse. He expanded the TARP, which was unpopular on the left and the right. And those people who you so passionately advocate for were pissed. Because they felt like he was bailing out Wall Street, and that's how he was attacked. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I don't think he liked the fact that he was in that, had to be in that position, but he did what he thought was responsible.
Let me make an observation for everybody, and this has really changed my thinking. And that situation happened 8 years ago, if you could believe that. 8 years ago, I was a spectator in the stands. Oh, today, I've been run over on the field. Okay. And so what ends up happening is when you go from being a spectator in the stands to being run over on the field, you get a lot softer and you have more appreciation for everybody that's on the field with you.
So no, I always say
I'm just being honest with you. So if but the truth of the matter is, as it related to President Obama at that moment, this is the stupid part of that whole thing. I actually thought I was giving him a layup where he was going to say, yeah, we've got to bring Main Street and Wall Street together. But I didn't size up the political zeitgeist at the time. Mm-hmm. And so he came back at me with what he said. And then, you know, I teased my friends. I said, you know, when are you going to stop whacking Wall Street with the piñata? You probably shouldn't use the word whack as an Italian-American on live TV in front of the president. But that's fine. Look, I mean, the truth of the matter is I respect him. I think he's a great American. You've never heard me say anything bad about him. I mean, we ran against him with Governor Romney. We can talk about Governor Romney in a second. Mm-hmm. I've returned to my Republican roots for one base reason, and that was in 2009. The president and the team and Steve Ratner, et cetera, made a decision to abrogate 800 years of commercial contract law where they divided up the assets of then General Motors, and they gave a big slice of it to the unions. And now you could say, well, that was very good politics. It worked out. General Motors is flourishing and all that other stuff. But at that time, because of the financial crisis, making a decision like that to move the ball on commercial contract law, where I can tell you that some of the best things about our country, immigration is one of the greatest things, but the real great thing about our country is the stability and the predictability and the enforcement of our court system and our laws. That's what really has made the country flourish, where we've been able to, if you read, Poverty of Nations, Wealth and Poverty of Nations, Landis's book,
yeah.
South America is in a disaster zone.
No, listen, I'm a big believer in our rule of law institutions. I mean, that's one of my concerns now.
He's a good dude. I like him. I respect him.
We can talk about the auto bailout and what would have happened if he hadn't intervened on behalf of General Motors and Chrysler.
No, I was for the bailout. I didn't like the way they recut the deck on the bondholders.
Let me ask you a different question. After I left the administration, one of the first speeches or appearances I made was at a conference that you run, the SALT conference. And I remember it very distinctly because I think Bethany McLean was the—
She was interviewing, yeah.
She was
great.
It was a great discussion. She does.
She works
with
Goldman Sachs.
Ken Griffin, who's a friend who was on the—
Ken's great
and
guy.
Ken was also an Obama supporter who ultimately— and made clear on that platform.
Yeah.
But his big complaint was too much debt, too many deficits. I don't like that he's added to the mm-hmm. debt.
Yeah.
And he and I got into an argument because I said, you leave one thing out of the narrative, which is the greatest financial crisis since the Great Depression and an economic downturn. And we actually needed the jolt in our economy. I only raise this now because we've had this tax bill that the CBO says would add significantly to the debt. And now Congress is about to vote on a spending bill that would add $300 billion. And, you know, there was a reason that those that spending had to happen then, because we were in the depths of this recession, and economists were pretty clear that we needed that jolt. We're not in a recession now. And you saw what happened on Wall Street today as we sit here. There's real concern about interest rates, and part of it is this debt issue. So what happened here? And
so, I mean, I probably have a tendency to give long-winded answers, I guess.
Well, that's all right. I got asking you a long-winded question.
Yeah, but I'm gonna just say it in less than 2 minutes. So Dick Darman, we Ronald Reagan, we spend guns and butter, we blow out the Soviet Union, we've got massive out-of-control deficit spending as a percentage of GDP. Dick Darman goes to George Herbert Walker Bush and says, we got to put pay-as-you-go legislation in place to protect the Congress and protect everybody. So a reminder of pay-as-you-go for your listeners. If we're going to have a tax cut, we're going to have a concomitant cut in military, social spending, et cetera. If we're going to raise social services and military, concomitantly have a tax increase. So one of the best decisions that President William Jefferson Clinton made in March of 1993 was to adhere to the pay-as-you-go legislation that was created by Dick Darman and George Herbert Walker Bush. Why is this important? 2000, we're running a $238 billion surplus, last surplus we ran, the one prior to that, 1969. So now we're running the surplus, and if Gore won, he was going to put the surplus into infrastructure, and if Bush won, he was going to put it into tax cuts. So the real spending president, ultimately, the great irony, was the conservative George W. Bush. So he blew the hole in the system. So President Obama came in and played off of the same playbook. So these guys tacked on $13 trillion of debt.
Yeah, but Anthony.
Let me just finish because it's important to make this point. They tacked on $13 trillion of debt in 8 years. I think that the tax cut was necessary because you've got to make the American corporations more competitive globally if you want to bring these corporations into the country. But you're making the point it's not deficit.
And why is debt bad when we needed to, when the country was in desperate shape? I mean, the fact is that under the Obama years, the deficit came down by two-thirds.
David, you got to split the debt. There's credit card debt where you're spending on things like programs that are consumption in their orientation. And
how about the $300 billion that they're voting on right now? I mean, the adding of $300 billion
So, my opinion of the whole thing is that we are completely out of whack. My opinion of the whole thing is this group is focused too much on left and right and not right or wrong. My opinion on the thing is if you got a group of people here from the University of Chicago and said, drop your politics, here's how we got to put the tax code together, and we've got to get to, you're not going to get there today, but we got to get to by 2028 a deficit neutral program in the United States so that we can start paying down this debt so that the standard of living for our people 15 or 20 years from now doesn't continue to go down. So they're not doing that. So the Republicans got hold of it. I don't like the deficit spending. I think deficit spending is unfunded tax liability for future generations.
So if you were sitting in Congress, would you vote for it right now?
Well, the good news is I'm not sitting in Congress, and if
the
I'd probably take Rand Paul's approach to it,
Which is you wouldn't vote for it.
Yeah, because I would say this is a disaster long term. This is going to be a disaster, and you know what we should do? Rather than play the game of political expediency and be focused on a news cycle and sound bites, and let's see if we can win today's news cycle. Why don't we do something really good?
Do you think that the markets? It is a fair thing to say that the markets today are reacting negatively to the additional debt.
I think the markets are reacting to some of the personnel stuff that's going on inside the White House. I think they're a little worried about that, okay? And I think the market is worried about the forward tax plan and the forward deficit spending, because if you're telling me I'm going from 35 to 21, I just got a 40% reduction in my corporate tax, which means if I'm a good CEO, I can print 50% increase in my EPS, which is why the market went up 30%. So now the market's correcting. It's correcting because it went up too quickly. That's a residual reversal, but it's also correcting because people are saying, okay, wait a minute.
What about inflation, interest rates?
Some of that's in there, but not a lot of that, to be honest, because if you look at historical trends, the 10-year is still below 3%. And so you don't really have that. You know, the weird thing about the world right now, you still have a specter of deflation going on in the world. You still have quantitative easing going on in Europe, even though we're raising, other countries are easing.
It's been a pretty robust year for the global economy.
It's been a robust year, but you still have deflation. And the reason why you have deflation is that you have excess labor around the world, you have excess factory capacity, and you still have 2.5 million homes in the United States that are underwater relative to the Great Recession. So remember, deflation is the Darth Vader Death Star sitting outside the Earth's atmosphere that can laser into the Earth and blow the Earth to smithereens. And most average Americans don't understand deflation. But why is deflation so bad, David?
You're bumming out my.
But why is deflation so bad?
Well, I don't want to have this
to do with. Well, it has to do with debt. You were talking about debt.
I understand that.
So that's
But here, there's so much that we need to get to, and okay, I don't want to go all CNBC on everybody. My main question was, I can go in any direction you want, but I know that
deflation is a huge thing because you could carry.
All I'm saying is, if you are concerned about debt, I mean, there was a straight-faced argument for spending when the economy was shrinking by 8.9%. If you can oppose it then on the grounds of not adding to the debt. And blowing up deficits, how do you justify it now?
You're talking about, again, this is me talking. It's not the.
I mean, you already answered it, which you said you don't agree with.
I don't agree with it right now. But here's what I agree with. Okay, the principal focus of our policymakers should be growth. Uber alles. Okay, debt. Okay, if it's managed properly, coincident to growth, we'll be just fine. We had 105% debt to GDP coming out of World War II. We never paid that debt back. We just happened to miraculously grow the economy by quantums after World War II. So the percentage of the debt that we were carrying on our balance sheet relative to our GDP was okay. Where I applaud the Obama administration and Chairman Bernanke and that whole team, and I would also give Hank Paulson some credit, mm-hmm, to be fair,
mm-hmm, yes,
is that they looked at the situation and said, okay, if we don't correct the situation, we're going to go to a massive global depression and likely a third world war. So let's get the debt level up to where it was at World War II to protect us from doing that. They did that. I give them huge credit for it.
And then they brought the debt down as a percentage.
Towards the end they did, but it's still too high.
We got to take a break. We'll be right back.
The rent is too high. The debt is too high. You know, it's just too high.
You mentioned Mitt Romney before. He's mm-hmm. talking about running for the Senate. Apparently, he's going mm-hmm. to announce in the coming week.
Yeah,
you supportive of that?
Listen, I love Governor Romney. I'm very supportive of Governor Romney, but I would like the Civil War to end in the party. Okay, the party is split between never Trumpers, sometimes Trumpers, and always Trumpers. And so
he's been kind of a never Trumper.
He's probably a never Trumper. You know,
keep you from writing a check for him this time?
No, I would write a check. You know, if Spencer called me as five, I would write a check for Governor Romney. I like Governor Romney. I'm about people, David. I like people. I wrote a check for Barack Obama in 2008. Like him as a guy. I would write a check to Governor Romney. But I would say to Governor Romney, not that he would listen to me, but I would say to Governor Romney, you know, let's figure out a way to get on the same team. We're all wearing the same jersey. And let's try to advance an agenda that's positive for all of the American people, not just the people that are in our party.
We talked about the 11 days you were in the White House. It culminated with the appointment of General Kelly as the chief mm-hmm. of staff. He called you in and dismissed you.
Yeah.
What do you make of what's going on now? With this Rob Porter situation, if General Kelly had knowledge of what what was in this guy's background, should he not have had the Scaramucci conversation with him?
Well, listen, you know, I know Rob. I'm surprised to hear about all the stuff related to him. He treated me very fairly, Rob Porter.
Staff secretary.
I thought, you know, listen, I've You've never heard me, nor will you ever hear me say a bad thing about General Kelly. He fired me like a gentleman. I took it like a gentleman. I walked out graciously. I've said to people publicly, I deserve to be fired because I got caught on what I thought was off the record, and the kid decided he was going to put it on the record. My fault. I own
Ryan
it.
Ryan Lizhov in the New Yorker.
Yeah, I own it. He's not at the New Yorker anymore. He got fired because he's a loser, but I own it.
And, I thought you don't say unkind words about anybody.
No, I didn't say I don't say unkind words about anybody. I said that I'll call balls and strikes as I see them. I said I won't say anything unkind about General Kelly because he treated me fairly, and he decided to make a decision to fire me, and the president backed him up. And so, c'est la vie, you serve, as you know. These are tough jobs. The president's got a tough job. Kelly's got a tough job. You serve at their discretion and leisure. If it was time in on July 21st, time out on July 31st, no problem. I say very bad words about Reince Priebus.
Yeah, you did in that interview.
I say very bad words about Steve Bannon.
Why do you say bad words about them?
Because I call balls and strikes.
No, I understand. But tell me specifically.
They're horrific guys. They're bad guys. They represent... they are avatars for what people hate about Washington. They represent that. They are dishonest. They're mischievous. They're leakers. They do things that the American people would be aghast at if you said, my God, that's how these people operate? What are they doing? They're here to serve me. I'm not here to serve them.
Steve Bannon would say he's the guy who's been waging war on Washington establishment.
We can talk about Steve. Steve Bannon is a liar. He's a messianic figure. He's a nihilist. He hurt the president. He did take my expletives out of what I said 6-8 months ago. I built two companies. I was the Ernst & Young Entrepreneur of the Year in 2011. I know how to evaluate talent. I told the president, this guy only cares about himself. He only cares about his brand. Okay. And he actually really believes, like the whole Liar and Furious book, you know, I call it Liar and Furious because Wolf is a liar and Bannon is furious, liar and furious. It's just a bunch of jokes. I mean, it was just a nonsensical, fiction book in a nonfiction category. But Bannon really thought that this was going to be his coming out party where you were going to get Trumpism without Trump. And he was telling people that Trump is an empty vessel and he is the puppet master of Trump and Trump is just his hand puppet. This guy's a complete loser. So I have no problem.
And
I say bad things about people when it's true.
Do you think he's blown himself up completely or will he be ushered back into the...
It's America. You know, F. Scott Fitzgerald, we were talking about him earlier. Okay, he said there are no second acts in America. That was something he got way wrong. This is America. People come back from everything in America.
I'm asking about Donald J. Trump, not F. Scott Fitzgerald.
Trump let him back in?
Yes.
I don't think so. No, because, you know, Trump is really on to him now. President Trump knows that this guy's a joke, you know, and he knows he's a dishonest dude.
Mm-hmm. How much do you talk to the president?
Not much. That's the other thing I love about these guys. I talk to the president 20 times a week. I mean, of course he doesn't do that. I mean, anybody that tells you that they're outside of the White House, particularly in the Kelly regime, that they're talking regularly to the president or big time fibbers. I don't talk to the president much. I think the last time we talked was after the Bannon fiasco unfolded, where he said to me, hey man, you were right. I need some help. I go out back on TV. So I said, no problem, sir. I'll go back on TV.
So back on the Kelly.
A month ago, Dave.
On the Kelly matter. So Porter has these allegations against him by both his ex-wives. Mm-hmm. And the FBI apparently knew that. Mm-hmm. He never got security. You weren't there long enough to get your security clearance. He's been there for 18 months.
No, I had a security clearance because you have to remember I got the OPL job. What these guys did to me is the president named me for the OPL job, and then they did their Washington sinister
tricks. Okay, so you had it, but he hasn't. He did not have permanent security clearance, and yet he was the guy who was closest to the president in terms of handling all of the correspondence. I can't imagine in the White House. I served during White House that a guy would sit there without his clearance and have those allegations.
I'm happy to call balls and strikes, but I got to sit behind the plate and see the pitches coming in. You know, in this situation, I don't really actually know what happened. I know he's saying that the thing isn't true. It certainly looks true. If that was my daughter.
He resigned.
Okay, if that was my daughter.
You saw the pictures.
I did see the pictures. So if that was my daughter, this guy would have a hard time with me. I mean, I just let you know that. Okay. So for me, I'm not saying physically, but I would sue him. I would go after him. You're not allowed to do that to somebody. That's a horrific thing. So, but I didn't say he did it. We both are saying that it's allegations, but I wasn't there, so I can't call the pitches. You know, I don't know what General Kelly knew about the situation. I don't know when he got the briefing on it, didn't get the briefing on it. Raj said today from the press podium that General Kelly learned the full extent of this thing on Tuesday. Do you believe that?
You worked in the
White House. Do you believe that?
I think if there was a reason why his clearance was held up for 18 months.
Okay, so then this is what I would say. Because we both know this, because I'm looking at all these beautiful books on your bookshelf here, the cover-up is always worse than the crime. I would say, geez, you know, I knew about it. I was going to give the guy a pass because he told me it wasn't true. And I apologize to the American people for that. He's been let go, and I'd still like to keep my job. That's what I would do if I was General Kelly. But what I wouldn't do if I was General Kelly is say, geez, you know, I didn't know about it when I knew about it, or try to cover it up. Because what ends up happening, we're in a society right now. I have a movie studio. I have a radio studio. I have a television studio right here in my hand. See it? And so we're in a society now where everyone's got to find out anything anyway.
Holding up his cell phone for those of you who
but that's
can't.
It. So that's me. You know, yeah. So I don't. I think it's a very bad idea. We're almost in a fully transparent society now, like in David Egger's book, The Circle. So to me, you know, this is why I have a fan base with the millennials. They're like, all right, this dude is at least telling me the truth.
Right,
it's coming right at me.
One other question related to this. Apparently, Hope Hicks, and I guess everyone's acknowledged this now, has had a relationship with Rob Porter. Maybe you knew that when you were there. And she apparently helped prepare some of these statements. Mm-hmm. Is that appropriate?
Okay, so here's what I would say. I don't know if it is appropriate or if it's not appropriate, but it's human. That's what I would say about that. And what I would also say about Hope is that you have to remember, I mean, people say I was only there for 11 days, but I actually worked on the campaign and in and outside the White House for almost 2 years now. It took a big toll on me professionally, politically, and personally. And I would say that it has done that to Hope, and she's a phenomenal person. And I would back up Hope in any day,
well,
way,
let me ask you
shape,
a different
or form.
Way. Since, so, since everyone,
so I don't
since,
know if it's appropriate or not appropriate, but it's human. I'd give her a pass on it. How's that?
I appreciate that as a friend. Yeah. I hear you as a friend. Mm-hmm. So let me take it out of the realm of her. If you were the chief of staff and you knew they had a relationship, wouldn't you say, you know what, you should not really be involved in crafting our response to this because you have an obvious conflict?
Yeah. Maybe I would be smart enough to do that. Maybe I would be more human and maybe not do that. I actually don't know. But here's what I do know. And I really believe this, okay, that she's a very good person. She's been very, very loyal to the president. She loves the country. There have been bad actors inside that White House. That I know for certain, okay? I witnessed it, okay? She's not one of them. And so what I would do is I would be giving her, you know, a pass on certain things because you're not going to get everything right in these situations. You know that, and I know that, okay? Now, General Kelly's a different situation. You'd have to tell me honestly, did General Kelly know? If he knew, then he's got to come out and say, listen, I knew, I apologize for knowing, and then the president has to make a decision if he wants him on his team or not, okay? The kid that was the cornerback on the Patriots, the kid Baker, I think his name, I can't remember the kid's name, but he sat in the Super Bowl. He was the kid that caught Russell Wilson's interception.
Yes,
you know the kid I'm talking about, right? So the question is Bill Belichick benching Tom Brady? If Tom Brady's got booze and chicks in the room and he's got a little drugs in the room with him, it's 4 a.m. before the Super Bowl, is he benching Tom Brady?
No.
Okay, so the question is General Kelly Tom Brady? Because if he's Tom Brady...
Or is Bill... the other question is Bill Belichick president of the United States?
Well, my point is one guy gets benched. This is the way the world works, the way human beings work, okay?
So you think Kelly's too valuable to be like a...
I don't know. I don't have... You know, look, the bad news for me, obviously, this is something that Petraeus... You know, General Campbell, when I visited him in Afghanistan, the day I got fired, General Campbell sent me a text, four-star general. He says, hey, the Army still has your back, okay? If General Kelly knew me for the guy that I am, he would have handed me a bar of soap. He would have said, go wash him out that with soap and get back on the field. You're a very good advocate for the president, okay? That's all. And I would have worked underneath him. I didn't need to report directly to the president. The reason I was reporting directly to the president is that the president wanted me to get in there and fire some people for him. Okay. And I made a mistake of handling it the way a entrepreneur would and the way a CEO would, and not a slick Washingtonian political operative. And so I own that.
You did was you said some nasty stuff about those guys off the record. Isn't that what slick Washington people do?
Not at all. I said that stuff directly to their faces. Hold on a second. Yeah. You think you know me now? How many years you know me? Six years?
Yeah.
You don't think I said that directly to Bannon and Priebus's face, to their face in Priebus's office?
That's different, though, than saying to a reporter. But let me ask you this.
No, well, I mean, hold on a second. There is no difference. You're saying I didn't go behind their backs. Hey, guys, this is how I feel about you. So when I come into a room and someone asks me how I feel about you, that's what I'm going to say.
No, when I ask you how you feel about me, it's one thing. When you go to a reporter and tell them how you feel about me, it seems like a different thing, right?
I don't think so. What's your name?
Zane
is our engineer.
All right, so Zane is the engineer here. Zane, if he leaves the room and you ask me what I think about him, I'm going to tell you exactly what I think about him. And by the way, if he's in the room or out of the room, I'm going to say the same damn thing. How about that, Zane? You like that, Zane? How old are you?
Sounds good to me. 26.
Yeah, 26-year-olds like that.
The question is, would Zane then go and publish that?
Yeah, so Zane could have the right to publish that because we don't really know each other, but the Ryan Lizov family goes back 50 years with the Scaramucci family on Long Island. 50 years, Frank Lizov knows my dad, and the families know each other, and we go to the same restaurants, although the Lizovs are not allowed into the Italian restaurants that I'm not allowed into anymore. But you know, so he goes and does that. That's like Italian on Italian crime. He's allowed to do it. I made a mistake. I own it. But like Howie Kurtz said, the guy from Media Buzz, he'd never seen anybody do that to a White House official in 40 years as a journalist. So we know he broke the bands of human behavior. But by the way, people do talk the way I talk, David. Imagine that. People do talk that way. Okay?
I
have some smack talk in my personality, but I don't smack anybody.
Let me ask
a big
you,
distinction
let,
there, well, right?
Let me ask you in just in Come the la- few minutes we Good. Have left here. You didn't support, as I mentioned before, you didn't support Donald Trump on the first try in 2016, the second try or the third try. You explained.
No, the third try I did.
On the third try.
Yeah, I was okay, Walker,
but you weren't,
Jeb,
you,
Trump.
But you were, it's fair to say you were skeptical about him in your comments.
It was more than fair. I didn't think he was going to do it. I sat in his office the day after. By the way, him and I go back. I liked the guy. I didn't think he was a politician. The day after The Apprentice ended, whatever that day was, you can Google it. Mm-hmm. I'm having breakfast with him. He says he's running for president. I said, you're nuts. You're not running for president. No, I'm running for president. I said, no, you're not. He said, no, I just hired this guy, Corey Lewandowski. He's downstairs. That was my last television appearance on The Apprentice. I said, dude, I've been in your apartment. It's four times the size of the White House residence. You're not going to run for president. I've been on your plane. You want to carry the press around with you on the plane? You're not going to run for president. I was wrong. He was right. And then he said, I want you to support me. I said, well, I can't do that.
But your criticism wasn't just about whether he would win. You were critical of him. You didn't see him in that role.
That's unfair. He was criticizing the hedge fund community. He was criticizing my industry and my lifeblood. And so on Fox and Friends at 7:15 in the morning, he was ripping into the hedge fund industry. At 7:29 on Fox Business, Maria Bartiromo turned to me and said, well, what do you think of his ripping into the hedge fund industry? And for 3 minutes, I responded. That's what New Yorkers do to each other. Okay. And so, hey, it was 3 minutes of my life. You're going to hit me. I'm going to hit you back. It's no problem. I'm ready for the fight, David. I know how to fight. I'm a good guy, but I'm not the best guy. Okay, if you're going to hit me, I'm going to hit you back.
So what do you know about him now?
But I'm going to hit you straight. I'm not going to do what Reince Priebus does, go behind your back and try to rip you in front of reporters in this surreptitious way for 13 months.
But that's
months.
What you did, isn't it, to Reince and
It's just categorically not correct. You see, this is the distinction between you and me. I told them to their face. The same way if you leave.
I see. What you're saying is it's okay that you leaked it because you also told them.
Told them to their face. If you want to say to me, hey, Mooch, I hate your guts, Mooch, and now you're going to go out to the Wall Street Journal and say you hate my guts, mazel, God bless you. But don't say Richie Cunningham, howdy doody, I love you, Mooch, and then run out to the Wall Street Journal and tell them that you hate
my
guts.
So what have you learned?
Zane is even nodding here, ladies and gentlemen. Zane, the 26-year-old millennial, is like shaking his head and saying, hey, this guy's right. He's right about this.
He's just cordial to all our guests.
Yeah. That's
because most of our guests.
You see, you're catching a little bit of that partisanship in Axelrod.
No. Why? Because
you're trying to draw a distinction about being a straight shooter and a guy that will play it straight.
I'm just saying, private or not private,
a guy that tells lies.
All I'm saying is that was a Washington kind of thing to do, to talk to a reporter totally and sort of dime people out.
Totally, it wasn't diming him out. I was taking him out. It's totally different.
Okay.
Totally different. We're going to disagree about that.
No, that's okay.
Agreeably disagree.
So tell me in 30 seconds, which I figure will be elongated, but I'm giving you a goal. What you've learned about Trump that you didn't know when you were doubtful about him.
Heart's in the right place. Really does want to do a great job for the American people. Definitely the things he said before the State of the Union, I remember having dinner with him in the residence, and something came up and he was really triply thinking about it. And he's like, you know, and then he said before the State of the Union, hey man, I'm making decisions now. It's not about like dollars and cents. These are like millions of people's lives are at stake. And so his heart's in the right place.
Do you think that there are people there who are willing to tell him what he needs to hear?
Yes, I think so. But I think that the problem...
Powerful response there.
Yeah, but I'm being honest. I mean, I think that here's the problem with the president. Okay, the problem with the president, he's now the president, right? So here's what happens, okay?
Yeah,
everybody takes a little pill, and it's like an obsequious pill. We could call it something else, but I'm trying to be polite. And then they go in there with knee pads on, and then they talk to him in a way where they probably shouldn't be talking to him. So... it's very hard. Okay, you've been in the Oval Office. Mm-hmm. I will confess to you that the first time I walked into the Oval Office, my heart was like pounding through my chest. And then I turned to the president. I said, I guess I ask you, you're sitting behind that desk. The first time you did it, was your heart pounding through your chest? Because my heart is pounding through my chest. He was pretty honest. He said, actually, you know, the first couple of days, yeah, I was like worked up. And then I realized I got so much work to do. He said something interesting, which makes him very human to me. The first guy that came in, the first state visit, I can't remember who the guy was, he's standing in the front portico. And now the guy's coming out of the limo. And the president's opening the door, you know, to usher him into that, you know, the crosswalk there. Right?
There are people there to do that.
Yeah, well, whatever. You know, he's helping him do that or whatever it is. You know, this is the president telling the story. But precise as possible. But he then – it dawns on him, oh, my God, I'm the president of the United States. I'm walking into the White House with this head of state. And then he said – and then what happens to you is you start to recognize that it's a job. It's an office. You got to get the job done. And by the way, by the fifth or sixth day, David – I did start feeling that, but I have to also confess to you, I still had the heartbeat racing.
Yeah. By the 11th, did it settle down? I will tell you, every time I walked into that building, I felt a sense of history.
No question.
Yeah.
No question. No, I said a little bit, but not a lot.
So the bottom line
maybe
is—
maybe if I stayed 15 days, it could have settled down a little bit, but I doubt it.
So there are people, they take the obsequious pill. Mm-hmm. I guess my question is, you pride yourself on being blunt. You pride yourself on being a New Yorker.
Yeah.
I grew up in New York.
I took a half of an obsequious pill.
All right.
And I basically looked at him. I said, hey, how do you want me to talk to you, by the way? You want me to talk to you like these other guys with the sir, and Mr. President? Or do you want me to talk to you like a New Yorker and a friend like I used to? And then he said, no, like a friend. And then I still couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. That's the honest thing, right? So I took a half an obsequious pill, and I tried to play it straight. There were a couple of things that I disagreed with, and I don't mind saying it now because it's 6 months later. But, you know, the tweeting at Attorney General Sessions, he was wickedly upset about the whole recusal thing. Mm-hmm. And I was like, look, man, it's not going to go well if he resigns. We got to keep the people together, keep the boat rowing in the same direction, you know. And I could have said it more directly and more bluntly. But he's the president of the United States, and so maybe it was three quarters of an obsequious bill. But I mean,
if you were a Harvard Law School, you've said that. If you were his lawyer, would you have him testify or appear before the special counsel?
I said on George Stephanopoulos' case, you know, again, from the stands, that I wouldn't. But now I've got to know a little bit more about the complexity of the case, so I'm a little bit closer to the field. Here's what I would say. If I don't know where Mueller's going, but if Mueller – my prediction is Mueller's not going towards collusion because I didn't see any, and I really believe that there isn't any. It's not to say that they didn't tamper with the election. I'm just saying our campaign didn't collude with them. So therefore, we know you're a lawyer or not.
No.
Okay, so the distinction is obstruction of justice. Even if you didn't commit the crime, if you tried to block somebody finding out the facts, that's obstruction of justice. And so that's probably the direction he's going in. And so now I'd have to leave on the table the President of the United States testifying, because I would need to prove to the special prosecutor and the people working for him.
What your state of mind was.
Yes, and I'd have to prove to him that there was no mens rea, no malice, no criminal intent, and I'd have to prove cooperation. So I think that the lawyers that are quote-unquote talking to the New York Times saying that they're telling them not to testify are probably not the real lawyers. I think the real lawyers are saying, okay, we got to leave this on the table because we want to make sure that the special prosecutor knows that it was never the president's intent to obstruct justice.
And just the last thing, because you said no collusion, and that hasn't been – we don't know what the outcome of all that could be.
No,
but,
no, I'm predicting
but why
that.
Did those
That's
guys,
why I'm predicting that.
Bannon, Jared Kushner, Manafort
– No, I don't think Bannon. Bannon was
a
part of the campaign.
Not Bannon.
No,
not Bannon.
It was Manafort, Don Jr., DJT
Don
Jr.,
Jr.
and Kushner.
Right. Why did they meet with someone who said, we've got dirt on Hillary Clinton, Russian operatives who had
– Well, look, you know, I was there – That was part of my 11-day experience where the president said, you know, a lot of people would have taken that meeting. He was trying to back up his son. Here's what I would say about that meeting. And again, trying to be as candid as possible. We were moving at warp speed. We were outspent 2-1. We were outmanned, I think, 1.6-1 on the other side. It was a, sort of a miracle that we won. And I think we probably didn't have – I think we were probably just moving too quickly. I think they realized that the meeting was probably – you know, a dud of a meeting and not the right thing to do. And I think the meeting ended quickly. Somebody asked me the other day, well, would you, meaning me, would I have taken the meeting? And I don't know the answer, David. So I'm not going to sit here and say, oh, I definitely wouldn't take the meeting because I don't know the answer. What I do know is that it was an entrepreneurial campaign. I am an entrepreneur. I've made a phone book of mistakes in my life. I probably made half of a phone book of mistakes in the 11 days that I was in the White House, maybe three quarters of a phone book. And so it was obviously a mistake.
I guess it depends on what city. But
yeah, but it was a mistake. It was a mistake. I think they shouldn't have taken the meeting, but they took the meeting. But I don't think that means they were colluding.
Anthony Scaramucci, you we could go on forever.
You're an impressive guy. I mean, it's a tough interview.
Yes, I'm sure. You look very,
very tough, man.
You look very
brutal.
Depleted here. It's great, to be with you. In all honesty,
I got an enormous amount of respect
Thank
for you.
You.
You're a great American, let's face it, in 100 years, President Obama broke the color barriers. He's the Jackie Robinson of American politics, and you were the offensive coordinator there, so you deserve your Super Bowl run for that. God bless you.
I appreciate it. I got on the right team.
Let's move the country forward, and hopefully, even though we ideologically differ on some things, maybe we can figure out ways to make the country work better.
All right. Thanks. Amen. The Mooch, Anthony Scaramucci.
God bless. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, part of the CNN Podcast Network. For more episodes of The Axe Files, visit cnn.com/podcast. And subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite app. And for more programming from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics, visit politics.uchicago.edu.